Welcome everyone to All About Windows Phone Insight Podcast 235, recording this on 8th of November 2017. I am Steve Litchfield. With me, I have managed to track down the elusive and very busy Mr. Rafe Blandford.
Yes, as ever, apologies that I haven't been on for the last little while. We've had some good guests on, so thank you to them. Thank you also to Steve for his patience. We've had some comments recently that people like listening to the combined dulcet tones of Steve and I, which apart from being very flattering, and thank you for everyone who said that, there was a few comments akin to we could listen to you talk about Pedro. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but we have kind of taken on board that feedback. And I think, as usual, this podcast will start in the Windows world, will meander all over mobile technology and all the other things kind of related to it as we sort of increasingly broaden what we talk about on the podcast. But there are quite a few Windows 10 mobile things to talk about, so we'll also be covering those off.
Absolutely. But I wanted to start, Rafe, because people may know that your next 361 degrees podcast season has started. And you've been saying for a while that your main device, but mainly for work purposes, is an Apple iPhone. I'm just curious because I've had the iPhone 10 here, and I've been doing head-to-head and camera head-to-heads between the Lumia 950 XL and the iPhone 10, just to be controversial and pit a 2015 device against the latest iPhone. But what are your impressions of the iPhone 10? Is it really the future of smartphones?
Great question, Steve. I've also had a chance to play with the iPhone X or the iPhone 10 and a couple of the other recent flagships. I'll start by saying that in some ways the hardware matters less, and I definitely think there's been less differentiation in phones, and it's been going on for a while. But also it's kind of this idea that we have got to peak hardware gets bandied around a lot, and I think that's true in the sense there's sort of no big leap forwards. But I'm still going to contradict myself and say actually some of the recent flagships that have gone kind of all display, smaller bezels or have... You know, that does feel like a bit of a benchmark for me. And in one sense, the iPhone X is kind of the poster child for that. But Apple aren't exactly the first to do that. They are arguably one of the first to kind of remove the button altogether from the front, and certainly very high profile in doing that. And I have been quite impressed by that. It does open up a bigger screen in a relatively small form factor compared to some of the other phones. And anyone who's seen the X will know that if you put a kind of standard size iPhone next to it, it's about the same size, and yet the screen isn't that far off the plus size. And I think that's a big deal, particularly if you do a lot of content consumption. There's been a lot said about Face ID as well. Can definitely see that catching on. It seems to work really well. And the interesting thing is, if you use Apple Pay or something where Touch ID becomes important, a lot of the time when you're not necessarily looking straight at the device, it's a bit of a pain. It makes more sense if you pair it with an Apple Watch. But that and the screen gets talked about a lot, and yeah, it does, lamination is great on that. It seems to really float above the top of the device. And yet then I think about it a bit more, and I think back to a device like the N9, which actually did a lot of the gestures and thinking about the way a phone like that would operate. Now, it didn't take it to the same extremes, and so I am reminded again that actually in some ways the hardware is still less exciting. Now, don't get me wrong, I do think things like the S8 and the Note 8 and the Xiaomi flagship and now the iPhone X have really kind of taken that forward. And it's obviously a phone that feels built for 2018, arguably. But probably the most exciting thing is the way the software keeps moving forward, and whether that's the augmented reality view or the use of AI to improve the photos it's taking, or the ability to do kind of machine learning models on the device, and the kind of what that means for third-party software. That to me is still the most interesting thing. And so in one sense, the hardware, of course, it's improved. But what is really exciting about it is the kind of fact that software continues to evolve, and you've got something incredibly powerful in your pocket. But it's absolutely true to say you can do pretty much everything on the iPhone X outside of the Face ID stuff on the iPhone 8. The camera is probably worth talking about because you did that head-to-head. Yeah. Very noticeable that at least according to the Steve judgment, the iPhone X beat the 950, which was one of the very first devices to do that, right?
Well, it did, but A, only by a very small margin, and B, because I was demonstrating the 2x zoom, which admittedly I do find useful. A lot of people on a lot of podcasts have been saying that, for example, LG has been experimenting with wide-angle lenses, which is all very worthwhile and actually useful. But for me, most often I want to get closer to my subject. I want to provide something more candid, or if I'm in an event, I want to get closer to the stage, that sort of thing. So for me, a zoom, a genuine optical zoom lens is more useful. I think the, as I commented on the article, I don't think the 2x zoom actually works very well in low light. And there is some suspicion, if people are reading the article and listening to this, that Apple isn't actually using the 2x optics in very low light at the moment. That's disabled, and they're actually still using digital zoom on the main lens, which is a bit disappointing. But I may well get the X in again, sorry, the 10 in again for a re-review at some point in the future, because I get the feeling, I've had the Google Pixel 2 in, for example, Pixel 2 XL, and the iPhone, I get the impression that the cameras in these devices are being improved with updates all the time. And we should remember, Rafe, that we've been living through 4 or 5 years now of Windows Phone and Windows 10 Mobile, the Lumia devices, and just about every single Lumia camera unit was improved with future updates. The Lumia 1020 famously took 2 or 3 updates over 6 or 7 months to really fulfill its potential. So I think it's fair enough to say that what we're seeing here with the iPhone 10 in terms of camera performance is right now already up at near the level of the Lumia 950 XL, maybe exceeding it with zoom, but it's only going to get better and better as technology and updates and optimizations come in through the first half of next year. But I would say the iPhone 10 is probably the pinnacle of smartphone technology in most ways at the moment. It's just a shame that it costs so much. But as I said in one of my recent reviews, you can see where every penny you've spent is gone in terms of R&D and services and technology and support. It's all there. You just have to dip into your wallet a bit deeper.
That's right. And I think also on the iPhone camera front, things like the portrait mode, which for those who don't know kind of allows you to have different lighting and sort of create arty-looking portraits more easily, is clearly using kind of some intelligence in the background to achieve that with the computational photography. That's pretty impressive because it makes it so accessible, and it's been a trend for a long time, but it's one of the first I've seen really impressive effects without you kind of realizing that you're using them. A lot of the rest of the time, some of that stuff feels a bit added on, and actually that's maybe unfair because there's been plenty of HDR modes and things like that. But it's right across the board. And yeah, I would agree with you. There are going to be updates to it, and I think it will continue to iterate and more, because there's actually a lot will be done in software. I mean, more and more now, smartphone cameras, of course, your basis is still the hardware and still the sensor and still everything else in the optics and the assembly there. But more and more performance and functionality is being squeezed out of the camera. The thing is, in one sense, my most interesting update for me in kind of iOS 11 and the camera is actually the fact you can now read QR codes in the camera without specifically turning on a QR mode. And obviously that applies to the iPhone 10, but also older devices as well. And I think that's one of the early examples of kind of having this AR mode, or this sort of intelligence in the default camera, before you've always had to open up an application, whether you're scanning a QR code or doing AR stuff. And there's been a hint of that for a while in the kind of native camera, and obviously you've seen it in things like the Facebook camera and the Instagram and the Snapchat camera, but the fact that's kind of being built in, and so I expect to see that pushed a lot more in the future. And this idea that the camera application won't just be about capturing photos and media, there'll be the kind of the frame stuff that we've seen already, but then also interacting with the world in front of you, almost this idea of a 3D internet in the world around you. And that's kind of where the augmented reality stuff comes in. And obviously Android is doing it with Google Lens as well, so it's happening across all platforms. I also wanted to comment on the pricing thing. Absolutely right. Here in the UK, the entry-level model is £999. It always used to be that £500 was kind of the barrier for smartphones. More recently, that sort of has crept up to sort of 600 and then 700 and 750, but breaking the £1,000 mark or $1,000 to me is quite, there's a psychological significance to it, but clearly there's a lot of people quite willing to part with it. And I can actually understand that, because these are devices that you use day in, day out. And if you've got it for 2 years, we're talking, you know, about maybe £1.50 or so, a bit less than that a day. And for many people, given the amount they use it, it's not an unreasonable thing to do. But there is still the traditionalist in me that kind of slightly eyes cross and squirm a little bit, particularly when you consider you can get the phone for, you know, £150 to £200 that does an awful lot of the functionality. I agree with you, it is absolutely, you know, peak smartphone, and you can see where all the money's gone. But as with anything on that kind of price curve, it does feel like there's diminishing returns the further and further up you go up that index. So while I, you know, wouldn't hesitate to say it represents, you know, the very best, and actually impressed that they've managed to push it forward. I actually like the design. It does feel a bit fragile, maybe. And I think I'd say the same thing about the SA. Incredibly impressive as a bit of hardware. And you can really feel how it's leapt on in the last couple of years after what felt like a kind of period where it was a bit same old, same old. Maybe that's unfair. I mean, we know that smartphones do tend to go in a couple of years cycle. But yes, that psychological price barrier. And, you know, in the last, I guess, 5 years, I had kind of seen smartphones coming together in the sense that the difference between mid-tier and high-end wasn't all that apparent, to a certain extent in pricing, but particularly in the features and functionality. Obviously, when you have that bigger price range, it's going to be easier to see some differentiation. And I mean, for example, I think I'm right in saying the iPhone 10 screen costs about $100 as a component, and it really shows. I mean, it's a gorgeous screen. Yeah. The camera itself is sort of $30, and of course, you know, if you're talking about £100 smartphone, probably the component cost for that is less than 50. So you know, you do see enormous range there. And so if anything, I kind of see that opening up a bit again. It'll be interesting to see what impact that has both on software and the way that people use phones, because I think a lot of people in the mobile industry and in tech and all the marketing, all the things that surround it, you know, they get accused of having iPhone blinders, because, you know, you walk into a lot of these offices in London and, you know, 75-80% will have an iPhone. Actually, I think it's worse than that. It's sort of 90% have a high-end device and forget that there are a significant number of people on lower-end devices. And that's only going to become more acute when you've got this bigger price range and kind of bigger range of devices. Nonetheless, you know, really impressive. And there's something quite futuristic about holding one of these really modern devices in your hand. And Steve, I'm sure you remember seeing the concept devices where it was all screen and no buttons. And it kind of felt like such a long way away. And now there are production phones that you can go out and buy, and they really do feel quite a bit different to the kind of block of glass with surrounding buttons. Now we have got to the point where we've basically got a block of glass and no buttons. And I know we've still got them on the side, but you can see where things are going. And I guess there's a fusion of the old excitement I had about smartphone hardware kind of rearing its head because of that.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, with the block of glass, I glass on both sides, we've also got to the point where these phones are incredibly fragile if you drop them, and incredibly expensive to repair. I just wanted to take you up. You mentioned price there, Rafe, and the £500 used to be the, you know, the benchmark, the gateway to a smart device. I want to go back another decade beyond what you're imagining. 1996, I want to take you back. This is when you were in kindergarten, Rafe. the Scion Series 5 palm top, it was plastic. It was breakable. It had a ribbon cable that would fail after 6 months. The screen was almost illegible in a lot of light conditions, and yet it was the cutting edge in multitasking palm top technology. You know, ran for a week on 2A batteries, yada yada. But that was £500, £499. Mm. And that was the price of the top-end Scion for a best part of a decade. But here's the point. Take 1996 prices and apply compound interest in inflation. Indeed. I reckon £500 in 1996 won't be too far off £1,000 in 2017 prices. So in that sense, that £500 marker has been creeping up. But then so is the retail price index. I don't think the iPhone 10 is any more expensive relative to the things you buy every day than those, you know, those first Scions were 21 years ago.
I think that's a great comparison to make, because Apple are quite clearly positioning the iPhone 10, and Samsung are doing a similar with its flagships, as kind of top-end premium. It's not intended in one sense as a mass-market device, and the Scion was kind of targeted as a premium device. You know, it was selling a couple of million units. Actually, iPhone X doing a lot better. And yes, you're right. If you compound a couple of percent inflation each year for 20 years, you very rapidly get quite close to that price. And so, like I said, I think it does represent value for money. But I guess the kind of story of the last 10 years has been the commoditization of smartphone, and a result of that has been, you know, component prices coming down, economies of scale, and so I think that's why there's a bit of reaction against the iPhone X and similar devices. And of course, you know, Samsung with its Note 8 actually was in one sense the first to break that £1,000 barrier, so it's kind of unreasonable to, you know, tar Apple with that brush solely. But also at that same time, we've got, you know, very cheap smartphones being produced, you know, really decent devices for around the £100 mark, and in some cases a bit less if you're willing to sacrifice a bit more. But yeah, I think that's a really good point to make. And as I say, given how much we use the device and how central they are to a lot of people's lives, actually, it doesn't seem an unreasonable thing to do. Nonetheless, you still have to recognize that's a lot of money to go on a device. As you say, it's kind of fragile and potentially breakable. But the interesting thing, of course, is suddenly you go, well, actually, is it, if it's replacing a laptop and a camera and everything else, you know, the old convergence argument. But it really is getting to the point now where you see a lot more people who are going kind of smartphone only and may not have a laptop, or choose not to upgrade one. You know, traditionally, you might have been on a 3 to 5 year upgrade cycle for a laptop, but actually you can get by with the older one, because when you do need it, you know, it will be sufficient, because you're using your smartphone for more and more. And I'm thinking things like, you know, looking up directions or dealing with your bank or electricity. I'm willing to bet the kind of consumer hours spent in front of a laptop or a computer have gone down. And we know from looking at the market research, and Ofcom have published stuff on this, as have many others, that the number of people who are basically smartphone only has increased. And while at the moment it's sort of around 10%, depending which study you look at, it's clearly increasing, and particularly if you take out kind of the work element, because actually a lot of people obviously will have access to a computer at work and will do a little bit that way. I look around and see colleagues and friends who have basically gone smartphone only, and family members doing the same thing. Of course, that also changes the value equation, because if it's your main computer as well, that's not an unreasonable thing to do, to sort of say, okay, that's going to be my main digital investment, if you will, and especially when it's sitting at the center of the smart home, all the other things you might choose to control with it as well. I think, as well as recognizing that the sign was around for £500, the number of things that the modern smartphone can do is, you know, considerably more. I mean, it's interesting, there is a kind of a Kickstarter starting with Genesis Computing, I think it is at the moment, or Planet Computing, to kind of recreate the sci-fi, which is kind of interesting. More things change, the more they stay the same. But actually, at that point about the richness and diversity of things you can do with it, increasing all the time. And I mean, Netflix is probably a good example. I suspect most people started Netflix on a TV or on a laptop, but I would imagine a lot of people now have switched a lot of that attention towards using it on the phone, and they may well use Chromecast or something similar to put it up on the TV. But that kind of consumption is also changing, if you look at the way media is consumed. So it's only when you step back and look at that 10-year cycle, you realize just how much things have changed. And yeah, absolutely, the most recent devices start pointing us towards what comes next. And we talked about AR and the camera, and we talked about kind of the screen and zero buttons and it acting as a kind of remote control unit for the rest of your digital life. And that's what's going to be exciting about the next 10 years.
Yeah, just looking at my own family, I mean, there was a time 3-4 years ago where their laptop would be their computing life and their phone would be the thing they took phone calls on and maybe a few text messages. I would say now that 90% of their computing time is on their iPhones or similar. They don't even touch their tablets anymore, and their laptops are perhaps used once or twice a week, which means they never really get updates. So when they do use them, they're catching up on updates, and they're then slow,
yeah.
Which means they go back to their phone. So it's kind of a vicious circle, but I absolutely agree. And that's partly why tablet sales have been tanking really across the world, because people on phones with 5-6-inch screens, you don't really need a tablet unless you've got some particular need for a really large tablet. So I think that's a good point. The Idol 4 Pro, probably the most recent consumer Windows 10 mobile flagship, came out about 3 or 4 months ago, and I had it in, and it actually, there was a fault, it went back, but I'm going to get another one in fairly shortly. But it's a good example of on that price spectrum, Rafe. It's still only £420, including VAT in the UK, which I still reckon is pretty decent value. It's a modern Snapdragon chipset, 4 gig of RAM, of which Windows 10 mobile can only use 3.5, but that's another story. You talk about bezel-less phones, Rafe, and the trend, really. I've been quite impressed, whether it's the Lumia 950 XL or the Idol 4 Pro, if you swipe away the virtual controls, which I tend to do in a lot of applications, especially things like Twitter and web browsing, you've then got actually an almost bezel-less phone in many cases, and the 950 XL has got a very high screen to body ratio, and the Idol 4 Pro, you have to kind of allow a few mil either end for those really rather excellent speakers. So if you take that off, then again, I would say they both of those devices still look pretty competitive. I even did there's a story on the site, Rafe, where I was comparing the 950 XL with the iPhone X and the Pixel 2 XL, both, quote, bezel-less phones. And you know, yes, the 950 XL still got some unique selling points, which I majored in the article, but they're all still comparable in my eyesight. I know I'm biased towards Windows 10 Mobile. I know I'm biased towards the Alcatel Idol 4 Pro because it's the latest flagship, but all of these devices are still up in the same ballpark, for me at least.
Yeah, you're right, and it's an interesting observation that kind of bezel-less screen, it has actually been around for a while. I guess the thing I would say is Apple, and actually it's some of its competitors as well, have kind of do what they always do, take things that already exist and combine them together and just produce the polished package. And in this case, I'd say it's kind of the use of gesture interface. And for those who haven't used an iPhone 10, you kind of swipe up from the bottom of the screen as an equivalent to hitting the home button. And there's a few other gestures that allow you to do multitasking and various other things. I said already it's very reminiscent of the N9 and kind of Mamo and Mego. It's also quite reminds me of the Palm Pre, and that was a device that kind of thought about not having buttons and using gestures much more effectively. So merging both of those things, and then you're right with the kind of bezel-less screens that we've been seeing an increasing amount. And actually, if you look at the iPhone X, actually the bezels are surprisingly big. It's just because there's stuff missing from the bottom and the top, it kind of is almost less noticeable. You look at the sides, and actually it's, you know, there are phones out there that have much thinner bezels on the side. It does remind me of the power perception, but combining that kind of all front screen with the gestures is actually the thing that hits the sweet spot. And you're right to say it's not particularly new. So that goes back right to the first question. You know, actually, no, it's not anything particularly new from a hardware point of view in some ways. It's combining it together into that finished package and sort of the perception that then creates of a phone from the future. And, you know, Apple very much positioned the iPhone X, I guess both in the numbering but the way they talked about it, as a phone that's kind of, you know, a year ahead of itself. And I do expect that a lot of what you see in the iPhone X will be in the iPhone 9 next year. You know, it's kind of a canny move on their part. They can use the more expensive components, and that itself will help the economies of scale and the trickle down for kind of next year's model. And because in one sense, I was kind of surprised that they went for having multiple SKUs. You know, they've now got, you know, multiple years of models in the kind of little and large size, and they added the X to that. And, you know, every time you do that, you're increasing complexity and the predictions you have to make about what's going to sell. Yet, actually, you look at the strategy, and you go, oh, that's pretty clever, which, of course, it is. It's, you know, Apple. They have people thinking about this stuff all the time. But as an armchair person observing it, it hadn't really hit me until I sort of thought it through a little bit. But, yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, you know, we kind of got off the topic of Windows a bit here, but yes, you're right, particularly the Alcatel device. I feel that that's kind of underrated from a design point of view, or at least from, you know, the, that, as you say, the screen to front ratio. But there's a lot of devices out there like that. And in one sense, you know, it's unfair to say it, but the Alcatel Idol 4S hasn't stood out particularly in our minds. Yeah, we've said it's a decent device, but it's not winning the headlines in the same yeah. way that the iPhone X is, or the Samsung S8, or Xiaomi Mix, or whichever device you choose. And that does tell me that there's still a lot of importance addressed to the way a device is marketed yeah. and presented to the world. And I think we'd have to say that's where Samsung and Apple, and to a certain extent LG, Sony and Xiaomi have been very clever. It's interesting, you know, that Huawei, who's also been introducing the latest of their Mate devices, and they'll be doing a honor launch in due course, are getting savvier and savvier about that as well. There's still bargains to be found. You know, people will talk about the OnePlus devices, but at the end of the day, they're all built out of the same components. Apple, having its scale, is maybe able to dominate some of the early run of those. And, you know, the Face ID component's a good example of that. And the fact that the screens come from Samsung and arguably are going to make Samsung more money than the S8 itself does. All the building blocks there. But yeah. it reminds me particularly the way you put them together and then the way you talk about them is still all important.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know whether you saw this, Rafe. I did comment on the last week's podcast, but I want to get your take. I wonder why we did launch that that Mate 10 Pro. There was a section in the middle where they launched their what they called PC mode. No, just get this, Rafe. They plug their phone, their new flagship, into a cable, which ends up in an HDMI connector, which they plug into a monitor. You then get a kind of a PC-like desktop appearing on the monitor. And get this, you can then use the phone screen as a virtual mouse or trackpad, and there were oohs and ahs from the audience. I thought, hang on a minute, we were doing this in 2015 on the Lumia 950 range. I do get the feeling, Rafe, that Microsoft were ahead of their time, really, here. Then other manufacturers are coming along, Samsung with its DeC system as well. My gut, A, did you see it? B, what did you think? And C, do you agree that this entire thing is still going to be a bit of a niche aspect, even for Huawei?
Yeah, no, I saw that. And, you know, it reminded me again that these things kind of get announced time and time again. And we talked, when Continuum came out, we talked about the Atrix as a device. It does feel like particularly the higher-end device is getting closer to getting towards performance that's acceptable. But fundamentally, there still does appear to be a trade-off. And we've spent probably, you know, 2 years talking about Continuum and the yeah. trade-offs and the improvements. Oh, in the next version, we'll get there. But actually, if I think about the amount of times I actually used it in practice, and not because I was kind of trying to understand it or review it, actually relatively few and far between. And I've spoken to a lot of people who I know have the Windows devices. And actually, Continuum is one of those features that demos really well. It's really exciting. But when it comes down to it, a lot of people who had those devices, they kind of had a laptop anyway. So it was kind of very limited yeah. use. And I wonder if it makes for a great demo. And the Huawei version with the Mate 10 was no different. The Samsung DeC system, I think we've already said that they probably have had less time to be as polished as Continuum, you know, different approaches. And yet, you're right. I'm just not convinced by the value yeah. for them. And I say that having sort of been a bit of a cheerleader about Continuum, so I feel quite foolish saying it now. It's one of those things that feels like a good idea in yeah. theory. Then I think about it a bit more and go, well, I wonder for these smartphone-only people, does that become more interesting? Yeah, I think it probably does. But it probably makes most sense when you get it onto a slightly cheaper device. So I wonder if in a few years' time, when that's trickled down where, you know, it works seamlessly on even a relatively low-cost device, will that be when it finds resurgence? I think the fact you're still having to plug in cables and it's all a bit complicated yeah. makes me go, I still don't think it's going to be there, because then I think about things like Chromecast or the Amazon Fire TV stick, and actually the way that now you're getting Echo and other kind of voice assistants starting to connect to the TV, and you've got Android TV and that sort of thing. And I sort of go, I wonder whether that becomes the way you kind of have that bigger screen digital experience, or can you have phones throw that on? It just feels like there are too many barriers in the way for it to be a smooth experience. And for me, Continuum worked best when I actually used it with a dock, and I was kind of yeah. effectively charging the phone and putting it into dock mode and using it to watch a bit of media or to try out at the stuff. But even then, it felt like there were just a few too many things in the way. So I think all of these things, they demo well at a press conference and people get quite excited about them. But suddenly when you try and use them in the real world, the kind of the barriers to use are just probably more extreme than they should be. And I guess it's quite telling in a way that Apple hasn't tried to do this, because given the investments it's made with iOS that running on a tablet, it wouldn't be that difficult to see it kind of via a Apple TV or whatever kind of run on a bigger screen device. But clearly they don't feel it's worth it, nor has Google themselves put much effort in that space. And again, they would find it quite easy to do so. So I think what we'll see there is the screens around you will absolutely get used, and it will be for media consumption. We're already seeing the way, you know, Google Home could throw something onto a Google Chromecast. Amazon will be doing the same with their Fire TV and with Alexa. I wonder whether that kind of functionality might be a little more prevalent in the future, rather than this kind of, frankly, old-fashioned thing of plugging it in as if it was a computer. You know, surely we can just be a bit more sophisticated in that. And it's Continuum, DeX, PC mode feels like a kind of 2000 solution to getting a PC out of your smartphone and performing a number of tasks, where actually I think you can probably remove those constraints and think about, okay, what is the task that someone's trying to achieve, and use all the components we have around us, all the bits. And that might be asking, you know, Alexa to show Netflix on your TV, or bring up a spreadsheet on big size. Because actually, I think about the number of times it becomes really useful. And actually, yeah, there's probably some productivity stuff around editing Word and Excel. But if you're really in a position to be doing that regularly, you're probably going to have a tablet with a keyboard or a laptop. Or for the few times you'll have to do it, you'll live with doing it on the phone. And the rest of the time, yeah, you probably don't need that PC-like experience. Yeah, but it's a great question, one I hadn't thought about for a while. Yes, but I guess I should formally tender my apologies for my Continuum enthusiasm. I still like to think it's an elegant idea, and, you know, it definitely appeals to the geek in me. And I've had multiple devices where I've tried this and kind of bought laptop-type devices in an effort to kind of make it work. But then you suddenly look at yourself and go, why am I just not carrying a light laptop with me? So, yeah, interesting one. The one place it kind of made sense for me was docking in a car system for kind of workers who are, you know, going out to jobs on remote, or kind of fleet logistics, that kind of thing. But then you go, well, maybe the way to do that is kind of car mode, be that, you know, CarPlay or Android Auto or whichever one you choose to use, because actually you can do custom apps there as well. So, yeah, great question, and really one that, as you can probably tell as I stumble over words, has been making me think on my feet.
Yeah, if I'm honest, the only times I've really enjoyed using Continuum and found it genuinely useful has been when I've been using it wirelessly. The moment you restrict yourself, as you said, to physically plugging in, and I did a feature on the site, Rave, where I said, look, you don't even need a dock. You literally buy the right cable and you can do it all with one cable. But it's even so, there is a wire about a meter long at most linking you to a big display. What needs to happen is the science fiction type world, Rave, where Mr. Rave Blanford, you walk into your office of the future and there are screens all around you, and there's the walls themselves are screens, and they wirelessly interact with your phone. Your phone tells the screens what to display, and it remembers the configuration you like, with your weather over here and your news over there and your social feeds over there, and it's all driven from the phone and it's all totally wireless. But I think the technology just isn't there yet in terms of bandwidth. Whenever I've tried to use Continuum wirelessly, and quite successfully, it's usually to get to display media, for example, you know, throwing YouTube onto a Continuum display via the Microsoft wireless adapter. But the latency and the lag, I mean, that the whole experience isn't yet there. We need a factor of 10 improvement in the Wi-Fi speeds between the smartphones and between the Continuum adapters or the Miracast or wireless adapters, and a lot more intelligence in terms of the remembering your setup and handling multiple monitors. So there's a big, big technology gap here that hasn't yet been overcome.
Yeah, and if it's like that for us, it's certainly not going to get into the mass market. But then you think about a world where actually it's not difficult to imagine, your phone knowing where it is in your house. There are various ways that you could do that, and know that you're sitting on the sofa. And obviously, when you pick up your phone now, it tends to switch on or may even unlock, depending on the way you've got it set up. But it should kind of know that you're watching TV. It should even know that you're watching Netflix. It should be able to communicate with the various other devices in your house. There's a good chance if you pick up the device, actually, you kind of just want to use the kind of remote as a remote to control Netflix. So that kind of, and the thing I really look forward to is that kind of context sensitive of all the devices in your house kind of communicating seamlessly together. And I've just started to see a hint of it with smart home, and I kind of mentioned it several times already, but one of these voice assistant speakers being able to control your TV or light switching on and off automatically. And I carry a presence sensor that allows me to do that, mainly because the phone isn't quite sensitive enough to do that yet, but it should be able to do that fairly soon. So I don't really understand why it's not better. And it should be able to work from room to room at the moment as well. And at the moment, that doesn't work. And I mean, there is an argument about not carrying your phone with you all the time, but actually, it should be able to deal with that and sort of fall over gracefully. And yes, I mean, I've talked about the incident of sitting on your sofa and controlling the TV, but that could work for any number of things. And so I think almost in one sense, Continuum didn't have the full imagination of what was possible. And that's what I mean by it was constrained by thinking of the generation before. And the stuff that's interesting is thinking about, how do those devices in the smart home, and actually it could be your laptop as well and your tablet, sort of work together. And we kind of see little flashes of it, the way that you can have your Mac laptop unlocked based on if you're wearing a watch or your phone's nearby, and the handover thing of being able to copy and paste things back across. But they're quite two-dimensional at the moment. When it gets really interesting is kind of there's that whole network of things around your home. And I mean, it's almost as if you could imagine, and the trouble is whenever I think about it, I kind of restricted by the same thing. So the copy and pasting that we talked about in a previous episode, there was a UWP app that did that, which was great. But actually the fact that I've kind of been watching some bit of content, there's a good chance that that's the sort of thing I might want to share if I pick up my phone, or might want to post about on media. And it should be possible to know that and have that information to hand. And that is that kind of intelligence that, if it doesn't work very well, it's really clunky. And I've got Alexa interrupting. Alexa, cancel. It's that kind of thing that if you don't get it right, it feels really clunky and it's not very helpful. And it's going to take us a while to get to the point where it gets over that barrier. It becomes really useful. Yeah. But I can just see the glimpse of it happening. And that, again, that's another thing that excites me about the next 10 years. And I do think, your phone is going to be at the heart of that, simply because it's the device that sits in your pocket and is always going to be with you. Whether the form factor changes, that will be interesting. Rumors of flexible screens and all of that still to come. And way more to come. So we're not going to run out of things to talk about, Steve.
We like to look ahead to the future on this podcast. And in fact, given that I just took us back to 1996, let's say we're going to look forward to 2026 quite often. That's a 30-year span. So I think we should be proud. I do have some good news, Rafe. Good news. Here we are. Excellent. Microsoft has been confirming support for Windows 10 Mobile in terms of updates and security fixes with all the different branches. So most people listening to this will at least have something on the Creators Update, which is Windows Mobile Branch 1703. And that gets support and updates and fixes up to June 2019. For people on Lumia 950s, of course, and 650s, and iClear Idle 4 Pros, and so forth. The Fall Creators Update, as it's called, is officially released, of course, for Windows 10 Mobile. And the whole device list is listed in our various stories. But that gets support now up to December 10th. December the 10th, 2019, is a very precise date. But anyway, the end of 2019. And this shouldn't be minimized. People will say, yes, Steve, but it's not getting maybe the great whiz-bang UI enhancements. Although I did notice that the fluid design and the transparency elements are coming into more and more of the UWP apps. But what I'd like to underline, Rafe, and suggest to you, because you're a cross-platform man these days, an awful lot, as I've said before, an awful lot of the Android phones in the world, which, let's face it, make up something like 70 to 80% of the smartphones in the world, almost all of them under the top tier are update challenged, shall we say, and the amount of security fixes that are needed. We've had various scares in the media in the last few months. only a small fraction of Android phones are going to get these updates. Would I put it to you, Mr. Blandford, Mr. Cross-Platform, is that Windows 10 Mobile is going to get these security fixes from whichever source will apply to both Windows 10 Desktop, Windows 10 Tablet, Windows 10 on Mobile. They'll all get the fixes for another 2 and a bit years, far, far more than most of the Android phones, which you perceive as being the mainstream. And yet this niche platform that we talk about, Windows 10 Mobile, will get all the fixes for 2 more years, and that seems something worth shouting about.
Yeah, you certainly can't deny the truth of that, although whether that's enough to make people stay on the Windows platform, I have to admit, maybe a healthy degree of scepticism. But sure. I love the fact that Steve remains ever optimistic. But yeah, there's actually a serious point here in that the way that the platform is engineered actually has made this more attractive from a security point of view. And we've said it many times that kind of Windows in a way is sat in between iOS and Android at the two extremes, and it is a kind of spectrum of offerings here. And you know, for all the advantages Android has in terms of kind of openness, lots of flexibility on the hardware, loads of manufacturers supporting it, that has not come completely free. There's been a cost to it, and Android feels the pain. Google feels the pain as kind of the parent company, and they've made various initiatives, you know, Android One and everything else, in order to try and fix some of this, but you can't kind of argue with the end result, you know, when Android is what, probably 80%+ in terms of market share of smartphones. It has become all dominant. So the reality is we are going to have a massive smartphone population with a lot of these problems out there. I mean, in defense of Android, I think a lot of the top tier manufacturers and the top end devices actually do get better support now, and they are getting, you know, 2 years worth of updates. You know, you will see a two-year-old Samsung device, you know, it will be getting updated at least twice. Whether it gets to kind of Android 8, maybe a bit skeptical if you're an S6 user, which is, you know, something you kind of go in open-minded with. But yes, you're right. I mean, if we think about some of the devices on this list, they are going to be having, you know, updates for 4 years. Now, I do wonder whether if that's slightly misleading, because if there were continuing to be a pace of Windows 10 Mobile or Windows 11 Mobile or whatever it might be in the future, I don't think necessarily those older devices would get all those features. We would see more kind of fragmentation on the branches and things like that. But yes, you're right. You know, we keep talking about this and that December date, you know, as well as being very precise, December 10th, 2019. I guess that's a thing we can mark in our calendars now. Right. It is, you know, a healthy thing. And you know, you're right. Yeah, it's worth shouting about. Microsoft don't get enough credit for it. But sadly, software updates are a bit boring, and they only really make the headlines when things go wrong, as has happened a couple of times to Android. You know, it's happened to iOS. It happened to Microsoft when they kind of broke compatibility between 7 and 8 and all of those other times as well.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any way to get people to value this sort of thing more, because if we've learned anything from computing in the last 10 years, it's the number of crazy security things that people will do. We'll all have our anecdotes that we can relate about, you know, social engineering or people that have been caught on fraud or somehow managed to get their computer infected with loads of viruses. And they'll, you know, say up and down, it wasn't my fault, someone got me. But of course, computers don't do things on their own. Well, most computers don't, at least. Well, I don't know. You think about the future and we're delegating everything to them. So they absolutely will be doing things on their own. But in this particular instance, you know, yeah, as I think about this, as I'm about to say, okay, well, actually, it can happen, but that will just make everyone paranoid. But yeah, you're right. It's worth flagging. It's kind of one of the interesting bits of news this week. And also, you know, we got kind of the update on the list of devices that are FCU compatible. It's all the ones you'd kind of expect. Yeah, I think you noted the Wiley Fox Pro is on there, which we haven't actually seen kind of out in the market formally. And there were a couple of surprises on things like the Lumia 640, I think it was. I assume that's because it's shipped in significant numbers or still being used in significant numbers, and Microsoft feels that they're able to support it without too much pain. Nice to see, obviously, the 650 and 950 on there. And then a whole bunch of these kind of Windows devices that we've heard about but haven't necessarily seen very much from the Veo phone biz, you know, ones that have launched in just a couple of markets. So, you know, for something that was, you know, end of life, actually these updates are still going out to a number of devices, which I think it's been said before on this podcast, Microsoft has clearly found a way of being able to continue to support these without having to devote major, major resources to it. And that's because, frankly, it can update a lot of them using UWP apps. And yeah, there's a bit of effort to making it work on phone, but it's not like they're having to rewrite the application every time. And some of the common Windows core, that means it just goes onto phone. So they can kind of do these updates. I mean, it'd be fascinating to know how many people on the Microsoft side are actually kind of phone specific or mobile specific. I suspect it's a much smaller number than one might suspect, and certainly compared to the days of Symbian or earlier Windows Phone, or you know, when it was Nokia or Microsoft devices, where it was thousands of engineers. I'm pretty sure I'll be right in saying it's at the very most in the hundreds now.
Yeah, it's now down to Joe in Microsoft, who is it's part-time job to maintain Windows. No, it's probably more than one person, but I suspect it's not a big team. Just a couple of points there. The 640 and 640 XL. In fact, that was the point of that feature, Rafe, is that those two were actually remaining on Creators Update and dropped for full Creators Update because they were outside the two-year boundary. But you were there with me at the 640 and 640 XL launch, and it did seem at the time as if those were kind of the last of that Snapdragon 400 chipset family, and they were kind of released at the end of a cycle. So they squeezed into Creators Update by the skin of their teeth, and I'm not surprised. And I wouldn't really want them running the full Creators Update, this later branch of Windows 10 mobile on those old chipsets. I just think it will be a poor experience. I think Microsoft knows that. Also, just on the subject of security, yes, the old mantra, security isn't sexy for the mainstream. And as you said, if you ever tried to interest your friends, relatives and loved ones in, but how can you sit there calmly watching Netflix when your device hasn't got the latest security fixes? And they look at you with a look of puzzlement, and you see, they just don't understand our passion for keeping things up to date and secure. But so...
Can I just check something? Are you the sort of person that checks for an update on your smart TV firmware every couple of weeks?
Every week?
Oh, there we go. Thank you for reassuring my faith, because it's something I do as well, because obviously that's another device that's got microphones and speakers all over the place that you absolutely do want to. Anyway, yes, before we bore everyone to tears, we should probably draw a veil over that.
Yeah. No, just one point before you finish, Rafe. We mentioned security fixes until December 29, and that's all very well, 2019, it's all very well, and people with a working Lumia 930, 950 or whatever, they can enjoy these fixes, and then their device gets an extra long space of life. But what happens when your phone breaks? I think the biggest issue now in the Windows Phone, Windows 10 mobile world is the fact that there is no real new mass market hardware coming on to replace these phones, and phones, they obviously do break and wear out, and the spares are becoming harder to find. We've had readers contact me and said, Steve, my Lumia 930, my 1520 has failed, and I've been on to B2X, the Microsoft repair specialist, and they said they haven't got the bits anymore, so they've offered me a credit or some Android device, and they literally cannot repair some of these devices anymore. And that actually, I think, may end up being the biggest reason why people, you know, Joe Bloggs, listener of AAWP Insight podcast, where he switches from his, say, Lumia 950 to a Galaxy S9 in 2018, may not be that he's dissatisfied with Microsoft software or the UWP apps. It may be that his device is just broken and he can't get it repaired. And that seems kind of sad and leaves a kind of a bitter taste in the mouth that it's come to this sad state of affairs.
Yeah, that's right. And it's an interesting one. I mean, I've seen various numbers around this, some that are suggesting as many as 1 in 5 devices kind of get broken or damaged in some way on a yearly basis. I mean, that feels a little bit high to me, but probably not that far away if I think about my kind of own personal experience and when I've had a broken device. And of course, that means just on that basis, you would have 20% of devices disappearing if there was nothing else going on. And you're right, they are increasingly difficult to replace and actually quite difficult to find second-hand as well. There are occasionally places where you can pick up a device or you see someone selling one or on eBay, but for most people that's going to be way more hassle than it's worth. And yeah, they will switch over to whatever is their kind of chosen new device, be that iOS or Android, or maybe they'll feel rebellious and, you know, go for a feature phone or something completely different. But yeah, I agree, that probably is going to be a reason at least some people switch. I think also, you know, as things go on, people are going to, you know, people do look forward and go, what's going to be my next device? And they'll go, actually, I'll switch now because it makes sense for me to do so. And yes, there's a declining software and arguably the sort of declining support. And I mean that both in, as you say, replacement hardware and also to a certain extent the cadence of updates. Despite this official support we've been talking about, you know, that will be the thing that makes it diminish. And yeah, I agree that is rather sad because, you know, they're clearly, you talk to people who've got these devices, they're still very passionate about them. Yeah. You know, we still talk about them with a great deal of affection as well.
Yeah.
But both of us are, you know, quite clearly stated, yes, you know, we're using other devices as well now as basically our primary devices. And yeah, you know, I guess there's a sense of inevitability about that, but it doesn't stop me kind of gently sobbing into the pillow every now and then.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I've never yet broken a Windows 10 mobile device. I know my Idol 4 Pro developed a fault, but it wasn't my fault. I didn't drop it or anything. And I tend to treat my devices fairly gently, partly because I know that they, in some cases, they are irreplaceable. And people at this point will say, but Steve, you suspended a Lumia 1020 from a drone and sent it up into the sky on a recent story. Yes, I did. That was my spare Lumia 1020. Aha, see? And I still didn't break it, even taking it up to 500 feet and then back down to Earth. But just to finish off, Rafe, there have been a load of UWP apps. I won't actually get your opinion unless you particularly feel the need. But if you go and look at the front page of the site at the moment, you've got a Podcasted, a brand new Podcatcher, Action Note, which is a really great way of taking notes, attachments, and so forth, and popping them up on your Action Center on the start screen on the swipe down pane. Backroads, a new off-road trekking thing that you might enjoy, Rafe, trekking across those Welsh hills. Taper Shot, which is a full resolution effects and editing utility, really good. The Pro Shot, which is one of the very good alternative camera applications for Windows 10 Mobile, that's hit the big version 2.0, really, really slick. Loika, another UWP, stores and synchronizes your loyalty cards and coupons, and that's again very actively developed. It drives me kind of mad, Rafe, when people say, oh, but Windows 10 Mobile doesn't have the applications. And what they actually mean is it doesn't have Snapchat and a couple of the which I know you've been chatting about a lot on the 361 podcast. But in terms of the world of productivity and usefulness and sensible English applications, you know, for the man about the street, the man who likes trekking across National Trust properties, the man who likes walking across the Welsh hills, there are actually plenty of really good high productivity, high usefulness applications, brand new, still being developed, and I take joy in featuring them.
And it's great to hear about them. I'm definitely going to check out Backrows. I also have long been a fan of ProShot, but I will point out that it's great to see what I would describe as these indie apps, and actually you see this in all platforms, both early on and arguably later in life. You know, some really great stuff being done here, and I want to take nothing away from them at all, because I think it is one of the pleasures of discovering new apps, and particularly new indie apps. But a lot of the time people do want access to the mainstream ones, and you know, Snapchat, it's easy to be dismissive about, especially if you're over 25.
Or Ben
but
Smith.
There are plenty. Indeed, there are plenty of applications that are a little bit more important than that. And, you know, you could talk about City Mapper or your favorite utility stroke banking application. And, you know, yes, something like Backroads, I haven't used it, but it sounds great. There will be a number of apps that do something similar, you know, something like ViewRanger or whatever. Sure. And so I can be still sympathetic when people say, oh, it's missing that thing I want. But you're right. People should not say there's nothing going on, there's no new apps, because there absolutely are. And I think it is testament to Microsoft's kind of UWP strategy that it happens, because obviously it's quite evident when you look into them, quite a lot of these have come down from Windows 10 or been released on both simultaneously. But it's quite noticeable that actually they often work best on the phone, because the phone, more than anything else I can think of, is an app-centric device, and people are so well trained that that's a way you add utility to it. It's very interesting looking at other things, and be that, you know, some kind of smart TV or, you know, an HDMI stick or a voice assistant, trying to add apps or additional functionality to that doesn't work quite so well. And it reminds me of what we were talking about earlier, kind of designing things for the constraints of a previous platform or a previous generation. it's worth remembering that the app is really the thing that more than anything else has opened up the smartphone and allowed us to do so many things with it. And that continues with some of these really great UWP apps. And if you're on a Windows 10 device, well worth looking at. So, you know, keep an eye on the site, especially in the flow column. That's where Steve tends to feature these UWP apps. If you're a developer, please keep sending the emails in to let us know about them. Steve kind of monitors these things carefully, but it's also great to hear from the developers direct. We can send things back and forth, and you mentioned Leica there being actively developed. Yeah, it's a great example of that. So, thumbs up all in all.
Okay, and I'm amazed to see, Rafe, that we're heading up towards the hour mark. Well, we're recording this very late at night, listeners, and I really thought one of or other of us would have fallen asleep at about the half an hour mark. So well done, Rafe, for persevering. I'm going to head off to bed. I hope our ramblings have made sense out there and that you've enjoyed this podcast. It's been great having Rafe back, so I'll sign off. I'll let him do the goodbyes.
Yeah, I'll sign off as well. As ever, thanks to Steve for all his hard work and kind of prompting me and prodding me to come back on the podcast, because I really enjoy recording these. We love getting your feedback as well. Keep that coming in, and please tune in next time.